consciousness. Gus came to his senses on the front step of the house and jerked away from the zombie leering down at him. Wallace.
You sick bastard,
Gus whispered in the shade of the overhang.
Thank you. You're welcome. For not shitting or pissing yourself,
Wallace pointed out.
Happens sometimes, especially with folks under moments of extreme duress.
Gus absorbed that and looked away.
Christ, I don't need this right now. Take your time, Civvy.
That made Gus exhale in exasperation.
Starting to really dislike that term. Why don't you think about changing it to my name, just to mix things up?
I'll consider it.
Where's Collie?
She just finished clearing the house,
Wallace informed him, looking toward the open door.
Now she's checking the perimeter out back.
How'd I get here?
She hauled you out.
She hauled me outside?
Carried, really,
Wallace said with that horrid, permanent smile on his face.
She's strong.
Gus pulled himself into a sitting position against the doorframe. Wallace stood back and led him.
Why aren't you helping her? Gus asked.
Wallace shook his head.
I'm slowing down in my old age. Just hold her back. She's better without me.
You're fucking slowing down, all right, Gus muttered.
And for some reason, that one callous comment stuck. Wallace became very quiet for several seconds, his dark visor watching Gus as if no longer feeling particularly sociable.
Seriously.
Gus slowly shook his head.
All on the table now. What's happening to you, man?
What makes you think anything is happening?
Wallace asked, the visor unmoving.
That's a joke, right? You just joked just then.
But Wallace didn't answer him.
Collie said you'd tell me.
She said that?
Yeah.
She say anything else?
She said you'd tell me when you were ready.
Wallace nodded.
That's my baby girl.
The conversation paused then, but Wallace didn't stop staring as Gus recovered.
Hey,
Wallace whispered at last.
Civvy, you want to see something?
Nah, man, I'm getting my wind back here.
Let me show you something,
Wallace continued.
Something that's been making me reevaluate my priorities in life.
With a dignified grace, Wallace reached down and pulled a combat knife from a shin scabbard. It was a straight blade, serrated on one side, but deadly sharp on the other, with the barest curve to a tip that might have tapered off into infinity. Gus didn't like the knife, and certainly didn't like Wallace's creepy Zen master tone.
You watching?
The soldier asked. Gus nodded with building unease.
Keep watching,
Wallace stated as he rolled up the sleeve of his left arm, exposing a length of fish belly flesh. Black veins snaked below the polluted epidermis.
Jesus, Gus hissed.
Wait. Wait,
the soldier whispered, bringing back those chills Gus had just experienced inside the house.
Only found this out this morning, in fact,
Wallace went on, holding the knife at guard.
But I think you'll find it just as interesting as I do.
With that, he angled the tip to his forearm, the blade gleaming. Wallace's visor barely moved, if at all, and he held the weapon to his skin for a long, solemn moment before pushing the steel through. Gus jumped.
Holy shit!
Wallace's skeletal profile remained unchanged as the tip pushed through the other side of his forearm, causing a black fluid as syrupy as snot to drip to the ground, and very little at that. For added effect, the soldier wiggled the blade a little before pulling the smeared steel out and taking his time wiping it off on a camo pant leg.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Gus panted in horror. Oh, Jesus Christ!
A heavy clatter rattled from behind the house, followed by two successive thumps and a splintering of wood.
In that instant, Gus was completely discombobulated.
"See that?"
an unaffected Wallace asked, his voice every bit as smooth as fine chocolate.
"Holy shit, are you—"
But he couldn't finish. "Okay? In pain? What could a person ask someone like Wallace?" Gus studied the soldier and brought his revulsion under control. He'd freaked out twice in one day, and his nerves twanged like out-of-tune piano keys.
"You better tell her," he got out instead.
"Tell her what, about this?"
Wallace asked, finishing cleaning off his knife.
"No, I think I'll keep this to myself. Ruminate on it, see where it goes."
Gus gawked at the man.
"Don't worry, I'm not turned, for whatever reason. Not gone over yet."
But Gus wasn't so convinced.
"Fuck you,"
Wallace muttered as if sensing trepidation.
"Fuck you, you freak."
Wallace's grin transformed into a frightening sickle, but then he hesitated. Gus heard her coming through the house, through a back doorway. She emerged in the hallway and approached her companions.
"All clear,"
she reported, wiping her forehead with a hand.
"Only the two of them."
Wallace straightened, but Gus balked, not sure he wanted to be anywhere near anyone as infected as Wallace. Then a sense of righteousness overtook him, and he got to his feet.
"You okay?" Gus asked.
"I'm okay,"
Collie said.
"Course she's fucking okay,"
Wallace said, an octave louder than his usual mantra-chanting level of speech.
"What did I say, you moron? She'll be around long after you and I are both gone."
Collie regarded the man with a decidedly pensive, unasked question.
"Collie, listen. That guy is—" Gus broke into a nervous babble. "Look, I know you've been with him for a while, but there's something wrong with him. More than you know."
At this, Collie's wondering expression deepened, and she regarded Wallace.
"What did you do?"
Wallace was no longer smiling.
"What did he do?"
she put to Gus.
"He fucking stabbed himself through his arm."
"He what?"
She glared at Wallace.
"You stabbed yourself? The hell you do that for?"
"Yeah. Why?" Gus demanded, then ominously. "Black shit squirted out, Collie, like he was leaking oil or something."
A clearly unimpressed Collie switched from one to the other. The soldier didn't answer.
"Let me see."
"I would have told you eventually,"
Wallace finally responded in a low voice, his zen wavering around the edges.
"Only happened last night." "That right?"
Collie asked.
"Anything else happened last night?"
"No."
"Show me the arm."
Wallace complied, surprising Gus. He thought the man would have protested more. Wallace straightened out his arm and displayed the wound, which had ceased bleeding. A clearly pissed-off Collie grabbed the offered limb, studying the cut in grim silence. She shoved the arm away.
"You said you were going to tell me."
"There was
nothing to tell? Are you fucking kidding me? The fuck you think that is, a paper cut?"
"It's nothing."
"Like hell it's nothing. I'd say it's progressing faster than you expected, than I expected."
In the verbal ceasefire that followed, Gus hung back and stayed clear.
"Your color's changed,"
Collie noted.
"You're grayer."
The visor remained still for a moment.
"Noticed that this morning," Wallace muttered.
"Ah, shit. Shit, Ollie. You're supposed to tell me these things."
Wallace didn't reply. Collie rubbed her face and then did a double take of Gus, as if realizing he was there for the first time.
"Holy shit. In front of the civvy, no less."
Gus rolled his eyes. She stood there, visibly battling with the urge to reprimand her husband in front of Gus, when the sound of engines drifted into hearing, drawing everyone's attention to the road. In seconds, pickups and SUVs screamed into existence along the highway, shooting out from behind a veil of trees and halting in a screech of rubber. Armed men spilled from the vehicles. Chapter 28
"Who?" But Collie was already pulling Gus through the front door and into the living room. Wallace lumbered in after them, closing the door, the grimace on his face almost painful to see. Collie left Gus at the archway and took position at the edge of the picture window.
"Stay away from the windows,"
Collie hissed at him, her own Sig Sauer drawn and posed at her shoulder as she peeked around the edge of the shears.
"Who are they?" Gus asked in an anxious whisper. "Road savages, freaks, killers, whatever you want to call them."
"What? How do you know that?"
"I don't, but it's best to assume until proven otherwise."
"Jesus," Gus said. He glanced toward the end of the hall where the stairs began, and his mouth dropped open. There, like a pair of huge cockroaches freshly squashed, lay the leftovers of Dwight and Ricky. Collie kept her eyes on the road as Wallace shuffled past Gus toward the end of the hall.
"Hey!"
someone shouted from the highway. Some men had already stormed the RVs while the rest formed a line behind the low beds of their pickups. Gun barrels pointed at the house.
"Hey, you in the house! You got the guys in there?"
"How many?" Wallace asked from the hall.
"Six shooters facing the house, three going through the RVs, which pisses me off to no end."
9-2.
3, Gus said, slightly insulted.
"Listen, you send Dwight and Ricky out and we'll let you live. Promise."
Collie cocked her head. A sarcastic smile split her harsh features.
"What about the RVs?" she muttered.
"What about the RVs?" Gus asked.
"Talking to myself. They'll take them. Guaranteed. And kill us. They're the same breed as those two sick pups I shot back there. An evil kind of crazy. Who knows how many they've killed up to this point."
On some mystical impulse, Gus glanced over his shoulder to see Wallace standing back from where the dead men had fallen. The soldier was studying the bodies with brooding interest. Uncertainty and dread flooded Gus's mental capacities. He'd seen that posture before. Wallace was considering taking a bite out of Ricky's and Dwight's bleeding hides.
"Ollie?"
Collie asked and met Gus's eyes.
"What's it gonna be? Huh?"
Wallace didn't answer. The back of his head moved ever so slightly, studying the meat just lying there.
"You hear me in there?"
"Ollie,"
Collie snapped, and Wallace turned his head toward her so slowly Gus thought he heard vertebrae crackle.
"All right, assholes. I fucking tried to be peaceful."
Gus's breath caught in his airpipe. In between Collie's whispers and the hollering outside, Wallace was moaning and sizing up the chunks of human steak marinating in their own juices on the floor.
"Ollie," Collie commanded, "you back away from that shit right this instant. You're not like that, mister. You're not like that at all. You're JTF, for Christ's sake, and you are not some walking ghoul."
Perhaps it was her words or the bedrock seriousness in her tone. Probably both. Wallace's shoulders trembled, twitching around the edges like a curtain about to fall to the ground. He stopped making noises and backed up a step. Gus looked at Collie and was about to give a report when Collie's attention snapped back to the developing scene outside.
"Down!"
Collie shrieked and grabbed Gus by the shoulders. A dragon's whine of smoke and sound ended with the picture window exploding. Scintillating slivers zipped past bodies spinning out of harm's way. The room went white. Time slowed. Then the house chuffed and blew outward. It was as if God himself reached down and tore out a chunk of the home. Wooden beams crackled and fell to the living room floor, while plaster crashed down in a flowery puff. Timbers creaked, and a huge hole appeared in a wall and a good chunk of the ceiling. The second floor revealed itself in a stunning gauze of wreckage. Splintered edges flickered with fire. Gus was on his back, not knowing how he'd wound up there. His ears were splitting with a pitch that would make dogs cringe. He coughed, wheezed in a lungful of plaster dust, and coughed again. Grainy water polluted his eyes. Hysterical whoops came from the roadside and echoed in his skull. A white hand clawed at his shoulder.
"Get up,"
Wallace's voice warbled with a distorted fishbowl sound effect. Dust clung to his person, making him appear to be smoking. He pulled a dazed Gus upward, and slabs of thick plaster slid from his shoulders.
Collie.
Here,
she responded, her voice sounding far off, and a ghost pushed itself up from the debris, pulling off a slab of useless-looking body armor.
Grenade blew through the window,
Wallace explained as he helped Gus to his feet.
Chewed up the house.
We gotta get clear of this,
Collie grunted, recovering quickly.
Not out the back.
Basement, Gus croaked and lurched away. Holding his head, he turned two corners, coughing smoke and dust and stumbling on debris blasted into the hall. Gus ignored the bodies on the stairs and floor and stepped over a set of legs to get to the basement door. He descended, slumping against the wall at one point.
Down,
Collie ordered, pushing him onward. The door closed behind him, plunging them into blackness. With another explosion, the house seemed to jump off its foundation. Beams groaned and cracked like Arctic ice breaking as another blinding burst of dust blew past the three figures descending into the basement. Gus felt a light switch on the wall and flipped it to no effect before Collie stumbled into him from behind and sent him flying. He crashed over something, clutching at what felt like an easy chair before slamming into a carpeted floor.
Someone boarded up the windows, Collie gasped.
The house rocked a third time. A heavy rain of debris pattered the floor over their heads.
Here,
Wallace said, and grabbed Gus's collar. The soldier guided him through the blackness of the furnished basement. Gus wrapped his lower leg off the corner of something immobile, crippling him and sending him to his knees.
Move,
Collie urged and shoved him forward. They fumbled around a corner while something crashed into the floorboards overhead.
You can see? Gus yelled at Wallace.
The soldier didn't respond. Instead, he pulled his two companions through the dusty dark. Gus struck a wall and another chair and hit what might have been a countertop.
You got a wide ass,
Wallace commented when Gus's shoulder careened off a doorway.
Over here.
Feeling his way deeper into the void, Gus touched the cold metal of what might have been a washer and dryer set.
Where are we, Ollie?
Collie asked from the rear. Wallace didn't answer. Instead, he stopped and opened a door, its hinges squealing. Another explosion made the ceiling shiver, and for a brief moment Gus's attention went heavenward to long lines of fire illuminating the seams of the floorboards. Then Wallace pushed Gus, sending him tripping and landing on a concrete floor, hands splayed out to cushion the impact. He sputtered, ears still ringing, and glanced back the way he'd come in time to see Collie's shape briefly illuminated by a hellish orange glow.
Stay inside,
Wallace commanded and slammed a heavy door.
The hell?
Gus muttered and sat up, feeling shelves against his back.
We're in a wine cellar,
Collie said.
What?
The next muted explosion made him cringe. He stared up at the night that was the ceiling, fully expecting to see a fiery sun come crashing down.
The fuck are they using?
Grenade launcher, Collie answered. Don't know the model, but they got their hands on one. Probably from a dead soldier or somewhere. That pause in between means they're reloading.
My ears are fucked up.
Are they bleeding?
Gus dabbed at them.
No.
Then you're okay. The ringing will pass.
Where's Wallace?
Outside.
What's he doing out there?
Covering us,
Collie said from near the door.
Covering us?
Breathe easy if you can. This place might be airtight. Or if not, the vents might be blocked. Conserve your air in any case. I can't see shit.
Gus shuffled along blindly in the dark, making bottles tinkle in their racks. The shelves ended, and he rested against a wall, taking stock of himself, while Collie stood guard at the door. Overhead, the great crackling intensified, as if a swarm of locusts or some other biblical plague had descended upon the house and feasted.
What's that sound?
Gus wondered aloud, looking up.
Topside. Things crumbling.
What about Wallace?
Collie didn't answer right away.
He doesn't take in air like you or me.
That should have startled Gus, but it didn't. Not after he'd witnessed Wallace poke himself without a flinch or a sound.
Should have gone out the back door, he said ruefully.
No, Collie said. With luck, they'll figure we died in the explosions. Only thing we have to worry about is smoke or a fire burning through overhead, but I don't think either will be an issue.
The ceiling's concrete. No, we hunker down here until it's safe to dig out.
And when is that?
Jesus, Gus, you're being a pain in the ass here, Collie said. It happens when it happens, so sit tight. Crack a bottle if it'll relax you.
Something crashed down overhead with all the might of an avalanche, and Gus inhaled a blast of dust. He sneezed an answering salvo.
Upper floor falling into the first, Collie confirmed. House is collapsing. They blew the shit out of it.
The rumbling continued, filling the gap in conversation.
What's going on with him? Gus finally asked the darkness.
He could sense the hesitation in Collie, and for a while he figured he'd hear another blast from above before she answered. But to his surprise, she started talking.
We were assigned to protect a government bunker up north, one called Whitecap. Huge installation. Bigger than anything with NORAD. Anyway, the truth is, the virus that turned folks into zombies was the latest in germ warfare, and despite the best precautions, it leapt to a carrier who exposed it to the general populace. It started in England and jumped the pond. The Prime Minister was notified by the British PM and advised to make for the hills. There wasn't any cure once the virus was released, but there was an inoculation that was relatively untested, as that was the fourth or fifth phase of the project, and it only had an estimated 73% efficacy rate. Worse, there wasn't enough of it. Anyway, fast forward a year, and the world's population has either eaten itself or had its head blown off. Over 1,500 personnel, including silly servants, are sheltered in Whitecap and slowly going stir-crazy. The PM starts to get a hankering for information since all satellite communications have expired. He starts wondering about the state of the country, North America even, as he's unable to make contact with the president in Groom Lake.
Groom Lake? Gus asked.
Area 51.
Oh, I know that place.
Well, that's where the Americans hold up while they dealt with the apocalypse and the meltdown of unattended nuclear cores.
Gus didn't like the sound of that.
We're fortunate in that most of our own nuclear facilities were along the border, so all's not all, Tarfu. We stay north of the Red Line.
Gus held up his hand. Tarfu?
Kali grinned.
Things are royally fucked up. Anyway, the PM decided he wanted recon, so he called on the JTF to sally forth and recon. He had a force of 40 stationed at Whitecap. He explained that the research team stationed at the facility had failed to improve upon the serum used to inoculate folks, a little cocktail called TI-48. Regardless, all selected JTF operators got a taste of TI. I did.
You're immune now?
I guess. Haven't been bit to find out for sure.
But Wallace has.
Collie sighed.
No. That's one we're currently figuring out. 2 6-man spec op teams in full battle rattle were dispatched to Ottawa. They never came back. After 6 months, another 6-man team was sent with the orders to recon and find out what happened to the previous mission. And they never went back. Wallace and I were part of that team. We got caught in a running gunfire with a group of crazies calling themselves Norsemen and eventually fought it out in an infested Canada's Wonderland. Well, let's just say Wonderland had the living shit kicked out of it. Only Wallace and I got out of that one alive.
So what happened?
We don't know. As far as we can tell, that untested serum had an above-average probability of successfully immunizing its subject, but there might have been a wee chance of mutation. Wallace noticed the changes in his skin tone. I have to say, when you're out in the middle of the apocalypse, 1,000 clicks away from safety... Well, he handled it well and decided to continue the mission. There weren't any internal adverse effects, according to him. We eventually located the remains of the initial recon teams in a courthouse in Ottawa, all dead or newly undead, in among a mess of terminated zombies. Having done that, we scouted out a good chunk of Ontario, Quebec, and Manitoba, taking stock of survivors from a distance. We helped them fight off roving packs of undead, leftover Norse elements, and other batshit crazies bent on God knows what. During the latter part of the year, Wallace's lips started to retract from his teeth like you see now, and his eyes became increasingly sensitive to daylight. His sense of taste diminished as well as he experimented with, well, raw meat whenever we managed to bag some free-range chickens or rabbits. Needless to say, this was cause for concern, which prompted us to return to base, only to discover the Whitecap's entrance had been blown and reduced to rubble. Something went down there, and neither of us wanted to investigate what, despite Wallace's deteriorating condition. We figured the virus somehow got loose in there and everything went to hell. All the while, Wallace was getting a little slower. And I... Kali stopped for a moment, gathering her thoughts. At a soft whump on the ceiling, Gus looked up, but nothing followed. I started watching him for signs of completely going over to the other side, she continued. Till now, only his joints and strength have been bothering him. The stabbing was new, and the most disturbing instance thus far.
You know if he's gone over? Gus whispered.
He hasn't, not yet. You saw him.
I did.
He's still himself.
Gus didn't add his thoughts on the matter. The guy had manhandled him into this improvised bunker. No deadhead would have done that.
Yeah, he muttered, and let his head drop where it bumped a wine bottle.
Outside the cellar, Wallace kept an eye on the laundry and rec room. His night vision had improved greatly over the past few months. Overhead, things crumpled and fell, hitting the floor. Some smoke had seeped into the basement quarters, but not much. Most of it drifted in through the debris that had collapsed and now blocked the staircase to the lower level. Wallace didn't have a gun on him, but he did have his combat knife. Not that he figured he'd have to use it on anyone. Wallace didn't know what had come over him when he pulled that chuggernaut stunt in front of Gus. Such a breach of professionalism in front of a civilian, no less, was unforgivable. At the time, however, he'd felt only a morbid curiosity and acted purely on impulse, counterintuitive to his usual self-control. Wallace had long since accepted he was going to die. How was the only question, whether it was from a gunshot inflicted by himself or Kali. Wallace suspected that any shot would be to the head. Standing there in the darkness, he could hear Kali talking on the other side of the wine cellar door. Her voice was low, but comforting in a way. When he'd been sizing up the dead men in the hall, he completely zoned out and was brought back only by Kali's voice. If she hadn't called out to him, he would have. A wintry freeze stropped the length of Wallace's spine.
Jesus Christ.
He might have tried eating those bodies, downing them like an old lung in a bag. What soldiers used to call the disgusting-looking IMP ration of omelets and mushroom sauce. He hefted the blade in his hand. A single beam of light leaked in from the outside, probably through a broken window. Wallace took a breath, discovering he could still do so, and leaned against the cellar door, thinking about what was happening to him and how much his condition had deteriorated. He lifted the knife. The blade came up like an exclamation point struck by lightning. Wallace regarded his still working arm, not feeling the wound he'd made before. Sniffing and catching a whiff of smoke, he sat down and placed his back against the cellar door. The men above might think Wallace and the others had escaped out the back, or they might think they died in the house. Or they just might decide to be certain and search the place after their shelling. That didn't really concern Wallace at the moment. What bothered him was his wife being alone with Gus in a wine cellar at his back, alone with a man he knew she liked. And the knowledge that he'd pushed them in there didn't help. That sandpapered his emotions. Wallace regarded the knife. Then he looked at his torso. Slowly he pushed aside the plate of armor, unbuttoned his combat fatigues, and pulled one tail up out of his pants, revealing skin. He angled the knife past the plate and cloth, the tip touching a bare patch of flesh. Wallace held it there, wondering how badly things had progressed, and listening to the evil murmurs of conversation behind the cellar door. He stabbed himself, feeling a pinch as the knife slipped in, right up to the first serrated tooth. Blackness oozed around the steel, but very little, dribbling down to the waistband. With clinical determination and a little morbid curiosity, Wallace forced the steel knife deeper, taking his time, the serration sawing the edges of the slit like a card in bicycle spokes. The weapon pierced the muscle tissue of his oblique, then found the curls of his digestive tract. A dull pang that felt more weird than painful caused him to straighten his back and take a breath, but he kept on pushing, pushing the knife farther into himself, guiding it home. The razor's sharp edge and teeth were gently ruining him without so much as a flicker of the agony he searched for.
"Oh, Jesus," Wallace whispered in horror at his half-assed attempt at seppuku.
Perhaps, just perhaps, he'd stabbed an area that wasn't sensitive at all, even though that sounded like complete bullshit. He twisted the blade, now half its length deep. The wrongness of the probe depressed and panicked him until he regained control of his emotions through a blast of willpower. He saw deeper, striking toward a kidney, remembering the leak he'd taken 2 days before and how his urine had dribbled out like watery toothpaste. The knife was into a kidney now, or so he figured. There should be pain. He should be unconscious on the floor. Instead, he twisted the knife again, screwing it into himself as though he was reaching for a set of keys and his fingertips had nudged them farther out of reach. The steel caressed bone, and that sensation wasn't lost upon Wallace, but it didn't hurt at all, as if his entire abdominal cavity had been pumped full of an anesthetic agent. The blood seepage had ceased. He pushed down on the weapon's hilt, angling the steel upward, feeling the tip clicking off what might have been his backbone, and he stopped with a jolt.
What the fuck am I doing?
Anxiety flared, and he gasped and placed a hand against his side and pulled the blade out between pinched fingers until he freed the weapon. Nothing bled between his fingers. What would have been a killing wound on any battlefield had only brought on a brief panic attack. He inhaled deeply, feeling his lungs expand. At least he hadn't punctured them, and inspected the slit in his side, which looked like a child's dirty mouth. Wallace prodded the cut, squeezing the edges until tiny beads ran southward. Then, on another morbid impulse, he inserted two fingers. Nothing. No pain. Other than the usual arthritic ache in his bones and joints, he didn't feel a thing. He widened his fingers, hooking the edge of the cut back to see, glimpsing dark meat. That was enough. Wallace sighed, fighting off his swelling panic, and began taking deep breaths, holding each for several seconds and releasing it in a slow breath. That still worked. And the fact that he recognized it still worked meant something. He held the knife up to his face, his surprising night vision making out the streaks on the steel. Overhead, the world smoldered. Chapter 29. Every so often, Gus heard Collie lean toward the door of the wine cellar and whisper. She then informed him of Wallace's reply.
"Still quiet topside," she said after the latest report.
"How long we been here, you think?"
2 hours, give or take a few minutes.
"I don't smell smoke," Gus said.
"Well,"
a smile accompanied her words,
"that's a good thing, isn't it?"
"Maybe they're still outside waiting for the fire to die down."
"You're a real positive thinker," Collie noted sarcastically.
"I'm just trying to think what they might be up to."
"Don't worry, they'll either think we ran out the back or died in the explosions. They'd already be in here if they thought we were still alive."
"You're pretty relaxed about all this," Gus said.
"This is nothing," Collie replied. "Back in the day, we ran operations in Colombia and Nigeria, along the Ivory Coast, Mali. We assisted SEALs on incursions back in Kabul, so no, I'm not really concerned with a few idiots with guns or grenade launchers. It's not like what you might read in the books or movies. The apocalypse wasn't picky about who it turned, and of the people remaining, hardly any know how to really fight. They try, and some do learn hard lessons, but most don't know what they're doing. Even those guys firing the grenade launcher probably didn't have proper training. They did a fine job all the same, though.
She ended with a chuckle. Gus supposed they had.
Where they got that thing is something I'd like to find out, however,
Collie added as an afterthought. The silence droned on for minutes. Gus rubbed the side of his face and felt the cool glass of a wine bottle on his cheek. It was right there. That made him shake his head. It was a test. Had to be.
Well, if we don't get out of this soon, I'm going to have to take a leak in a corner, he said.
Just let me know which one, Collie replied. We could be here for a while. At least until the sun goes down. We'll move then. Back in training, our final mission was a 72-hour evade.
Special ops training course?
Something like that, yeah.
That include, like, stealth kills?
Yeah, Collie said simply. It did, actually.
That surprised him, and she paused long enough that Gus started to think he'd asked the wrong question.
Those guys upstairs got the jump on me. Scared the shit out of me, Gus said, changing the subject. Especially the machete.
Well, you're still alive. Fear isn't something to be ashamed of. It's a defense mechanism. I'll give you this advice, especially true if your opponent has a machete or a knife. You ready?
Sure.
Walk away.
That floored him. That's your fucking advice? Walk away? What good is that?
If you don't have a gun, get out of there. I'm serious. A knife fight is the last thing you want to get into. If your opponent looks like he knows how to use a blade, run. And I mean run, like your ass was dipped in gasoline and hell's on your heels.
Well, that sounds completely dickless to me.
Hey, if you have a gun, shoot. Or if you know how to use a knife and there's no avoiding a fight, then go in looking to kill. I mean, ready to stab for the heart, throat, eyes, or balls, whatever is closest, with whatever you've got. There are a lot of people who don't know how to fight, have no idea of the mechanics involved. They think it's like the movies or a game. It isn't. Nothing's choreographed. In a life-or-death situation, forget honor. Mr. Machete upstairs? He was scary. No doubt crazy, but not stupid. You're talking about a person who decked himself out in a scary-looking outfit and put on a mean face. Great against most civvies, but against professionals? No, not gonna work.
Care to teach me some things? Gus asked, forcing humor into his voice.
Collie chuckled, the sound like bells.
You survived on your own for years. That does count for something. Anyone who can hold their own didn't just get by. You're already a badass, son.
Don't feel like one. Was drunk most of the time.
That worked for you?
Yeah, to a point. Until I tried to drink myself to death.
She paused.
How do you feel these days?
Well, better, except for what just happened upstairs. Living on the farm was a good thing. Balanced me. I had people around me then. Some good people, a few assholes.
Talbert invaded his mind then.
But even they were okay in their own way, in the end.
That's why we came back, Collie said. After finding Whitecap gone, we decided to try and put what was left of humanity back together again. At least try for some semblance of what was lost. And the only way to do that was finding the good folks still out there, trying to survive. I don't think I would have returned to base anyway, knowing there were people out here needing us. In a way, I'm glad the chain of command broke down. Made things less black and white.
Well, Gus muttered, stretching out his legs. Thanks for saving me. Again.
She didn't answer, but he thought she might be looking in his direction.
Sun'll be going down soon, she finally said.
They waited another hour. Wallace eventually tapped on the door before opening it, a wraith sticking its head into the cellar's gloom.
Time to go. All clear? Collie asked.
Yeah.
Her shadow passed before Gus's eyes, and he struggled to follow. Remembering the wine, he paused on the threshold and looked back, barely seeing the bottles.
Not a drop.
He'd gotten through that without sampling a single drop. The little victory put a smile on his face.
Happy about something?
Wallace asked, startling Gus.
Nothing.
Gus moved past the man.
When did they move out? Collie asked.
Maybe an hour ago, maybe more, difficult to say. No one bothered looking for us.
Sloppy.
But lucky for us.
Can we get up the stairs?
It's pretty hairy. Crawling through a window might be better.
Collie went to the laundry room and located a boarded-up window.
Well, if the cats are around...
She pulled the dryer away from the wall. Once it was out of the way, she produced her knife and stabbed underneath the lowest plank covering the window, working it underneath. Gus cringed at the wooden squeals. If anyone was waiting for them up there, they'd know. Collie wrenched away three planks and studied the night through a broken window and dead weeds. A wonderful breath of late fall air flowed into the basement.
Wait.
She picked up a slab of wood and proceeded to clear the frame of shards. Once she was done, Wallace crawled through first and slowly stood up. Gus and Collie waited, seeing only a pair of combat boots.
Clear, Wallace declared in a whisper. You go, Collie said to Gus.
Okay, but don't be staring at my ass.
He was mortified the moment he said it.
Where the hell did that come from?
Collie only smirked in the shadows.
Honey, if I wanted your ass, I'd have already taken it.
Gus wasn't sure he liked that response either. He awkwardly pulled and fed himself through the window. Collie wormed through a few moments later, and all three studied the house, which was blown to hell. The second floor had collapsed into the first, and brick and splintered wood clumped around the still-smoking foundation. Even in the dark, Gus could see pieces of destroyed furniture sticking out here and there like charred limbs begging for rescue. The nearby car parked in the driveway hadn't escaped the destruction, for the fireplace chimney had fallen right across its roof, squashing the vehicle. Gus understood why no one had checked on them.
Bunch of fucking hillbillies, he said.
They took our rides, Wallace added dourly. Well, Collie said, facing the highway, that pisses me off.
So what do we do? Gus asked.
Find them, Collie said. We know which direction they came from. We find them and take back our machines.
She turned and looked him in the eye.
And then kill every last one of them bastards.
The moon stayed hidden as if ashamed of the past few hours, and let the three companions trudge along the highway in darkness. Walking felt good and generated a sweat that armed Gus against the cold. Collie led the way while Wallace brought up the rear, walking as if controlled by remote. They were nearly soundless in their march, which inspired Gus to try to emulate them. A few times his boots scuffed the pavement, causing him to cringe, but no warning came from the operators. Abandoned cars dotted the road, pushed off onto shoulders and left to the slow press of years. Collie inspected a few, discovering the fuel tanks long since siphoned dry.
How far away you think they are? Gus asked Collie's back.
30, 40 clicks maybe, maybe more. Don't worry. We'll probably see or hear them long before they do us.
Unless something else does, Wallace commented from behind, breaking his silence at Gus's lack of stealth. My ninja mode is a little rusty, Gus replied.
Your ninja mode sucks donkey cocks.
Furrowing his brow, Gus glanced back.
Just asking in case, you know, you feel like stabbing yourself again.
Hey.
Yeah? Gus asked.
Shut the fuck up.
Gus shook that one off and decided to leave the operator alone. He felt oddly naked walking in the middle of the road, yet well protected with the soldiers around, even if one of them was almost a deadhead. But he couldn't quite shake the feeling that this little group had a big problem on its hands. The kilometers marched by, and the ache in Gus's feet worsened. Sleep called, doing subversive things to the rest of him. The night became an endless void where no sound played other than the shuffle of boots on asphalt. Gus listened, believing they were being watched at times, the sensation strong enough to spread a tracery of chills along the back of his neck, but nothing ever materialized. nor did Collie or Wallace show any signs of alarm. Still, he could not shake the feeling that something lurked along the road, but he discerned nothing in those deep, tar-like shadows. After what felt like hours, Collie dropped back to him, her shoulder brushing against his.
"You okay?"
"No," Gus answered honestly. "I'm shit-bagged here."
"There's a pickup here. Big interior without the suicide doors. We'll stop for a bit."
Gus barely heard her and realized he was dozing on his feet. He'd completely missed the dreamlike bulk of the vehicle on the highway.
"Great," he mumbled, and let Collie guide him to an open door.
The interior didn't smell of anything, which was a huge bonus. A four-wheel drive rest stop with unspoiled leather seats. Gus climbed into the back and lay down, throwing an arm over his eyes.
"Just a few minutes," he breathed,
relaxing so quickly he felt as if a dial had been flicked from 10 to 0.
"That's all I need."
But then he was falling. He didn't even register the door closing. Chapter 30. A hand rustled Gus's boot and he woke, thrashing, striking out all at once to a soft clatter of Collie's wind-chime laughter.
"Holy shit," she observed. "You're a human bear trap. Don't think I've ever seen anyone swing everywhere all at once."
Gus collapsed back on the seat and took a breath.
"Ain't funny if I shit myself."
"It's always funny when someone else shits himself. Good sleep?"
He regarded Collie hunched over in the doorway, dreary daylight beyond her making him miss true sunshine.
"Yeah," he rubbed his face. "What time is it?"
"I'd say a little after 7. The sky's just lighting up."
"You guys sleep?"
"I catnapped. Wallace, well, I don't think he ever sleeps now."
"Where is he?"
"Not far."
On cue, Wallace walked past her, muttering,
"Get that lazy sack of shit up, Collie, before I grab him by the nutsack and haul his ass out."
Collie smiled at the slackening of Gus's face.
"He's getting comfortable around you."
"Uncomfortable was better."
Moving his elbows and grunting, Gus worked himself out of the truck. Collie stood back and studied the land. Thick forest lay on either side of the highway. A thick quilt of clouds stopped the sun from showing its face.
"What's for breakfast?" Gus asked, breathing the cold air.
"Not this morning," Collie replied.
The dark circles under her eyes spoke of very little sleep the night before.
"Today we march and find those little shits that stole our property."
"They could be anywhere."
"Yeah. We'll see."
As it turned out, anywhere was only 3 kilometers away. Collie pulled Gus off the highway while Wallace followed into the cover of nearby fir trees. They stopped on a hill and looked down upon a sloping plain where a small town rose up on either side of a river. The waterway ran east-west through the middle of the community, while a 20-meter or so arch bridge spanned the slow-moving current. Timberland surrounded the town, the tree line marked by a few huge piles of wrecked debris that might once have been houses. Someone had built a service station with gas pumps on the far side of the river. A small grocery was on the other side of the road. A scattering of smaller buildings encircled the main attention grabber. A 2-story motel with the name Cozy Inn set on the roof in large red letters. 2 familiar RVs had been parked out front, dwarfing a parking lot full of smaller vehicles.
"Way out in buttfuck nowhere," Gus observed sourly.
"Here's what we're going to do,"
Collie said, pulling her gun from her hip holster and screwing on a sound suppressor.
"We'll move down the hill here, get closer to the town. I'll go in alone. You just draw their attention. It's still early, and if we're lucky, I'll catch them sleeping."
"Who? What?" Gus blurted. "Why can't dead nuts go with you?"
Wallace cast a skeletal grimace in Gus's direction.
"Ollie can't move like he used to," Collie said, pulling her balaclava over her face, covering it ninja style. "I'm up, so stay back and wait for my smoke."
"But
But Collie was already moving, hunched over and slipping between trees toward her objective below. Gus watched until he lost her in the bush. He regarded Wallace and rolled his eyes.
"I'm surprised at you."
"Me?" Wallace asked.
"Yeah, you fucking meatsicle. You let her go alone."
"I let her go alone?" Wallace repeated, amusement lacing his tone.
"Don't you worry about that one."
Gus's eyes narrowed at the man.
"Back when we were doing black ops," Wallace said. "Back when the world was chugging along. That one you're so concerned about was terror incarnate on two legs. Still is. Don't get fooled by the fact she's a woman or by her playing with you. That's a mistake. Old-school military believed women couldn't handle the physical hardships that come with being a top-tier soldier. Believed their bodies just weren't as capable as men's. They even thought, wrongly, that the women couldn't handle the psychological side of a mission, that they weren't mentally tough enough. All horseshit, of course, which is one reason why JTF recruited her. Many old schoolers still don't believe in hardcore female operators. Don't expect them. Certainly not one with her level of training."
Despite mixed feelings on Collie's leaving, Gus was intrigued.
"Yeah? What level is that?" "Most of her opponents didn't know she was a woman," Wallace answered slyly. "And those that found out still died. She was born into martial arts. I'm saying she came out of the womb with black belts in multiple disciplines. A natural sharpshooter taken beyond Olympic level. If she had only one bullet and three targets, she'd still shoot them all dead. Unmatched with hand weapons and an expert with explosives. Endured torture at the hands of some very dedicated senior operatives for 48 hours straight before they passed her into JTF. She outwitted and tagged U.S. Navy SEALs in some not-so-friendly exchange exercises. Taught the SAS a thing or two about evade and capture hunts. Her face is a historical canvas of pain and survival, of combats won. You only have to roll with her once to realize, thankfully, she's on our side. Then there's the brain powering it all. Masters in psychology, sociology, and biology. She's probably outsmarted and killed more bad guys than you have zombies. Collie's a primal, damn near supernatural, true-to-life tit-twister, shit-kicker, ball-breaker, if there ever was one. And if you aren't impressed yet, I'd suggest you establish and maintain a healthy sense of holy fuck when talking to her. Don't let that lovely exterior fool you. She's a killer."
All that rendered Gus speechless. The visor of Wallace's helmet did not waver.
"Listen good. Only gonna say this once. The Grim Reaper is a bitch. And whoever it is down there in that motel, they're already dead."
She covered the distance in under 3 minutes, slowing down to control her breathing as she neared the first houses on the outskirts. The residences appeared savagely sacked, their windows smashed and charred around the sills, as if someone had taken to using them as huge ovens. The smell of shit percolated around the properties. Cars sat in driveways with their tires sliced, their bodies wrecked with sledgehammer blows. A mountain bike lay twisted on its side, both tires warped, the bare bar, where a seat would have been, covered in an unsettling maroon. Gravel pathways had been transformed into dried mud footpaths tattooed with boot prints. Collie slipped through the little rural jungle, pausing at corners before peeking around, watching for dogs and other two-legged strays. She scanned her intended paths for tripwires or sentries before moving. She kept to the shadows when they were available, stayed on pavement, and kept her sidearm lowered in front of her. In some of their lengthier deployments, the enemy had given the operators of Joint Task Force 2 nicknames. The Taliban had called them Deathbringers. Colombian ELN hit squads had cursed them as Green Ghosts. Kali had forgotten how many men and women she'd killed over the years, never stopping to dwell on their faces or their history before they took up arms and made life miserable for ordinary people, private companies, or interests and investments of the Canadian government abroad. On rescue missions or just straight-out removals of terrorist elements, she never questioned her orders, only executed. They all did, with a professional pride that they were among the best at what they were trained to do and supremely confident in their lethal skills. When the apocalypse came, she had been transferred to Whitecap with the other JTF-2 teams, along with other armed force segments to protect the bunker. While the world died on a scale shown only in movies and books, she experienced guilt on a level never before experienced. They were warriors, protectors of the people, yet there she was, posted deep in the earth, waiting for it all to be over. That inactivity, that inability to serve, along with her leader's detached, aloof belief that all was well since they would survive, bothered her. She wondered what would become of those still outside of Whitecap after the world had ceased its death throes. When would they reach out and attempt to establish order, or make the effort to help the survivors? She had no family to speak of, with the exception of her husband Wallace, whom she'd married while in the depths of Whitecap. The bureaucrats wisely decided to ensure all active JTF-2 staff transported their families to the covert installation. Not all had managed to reach their loved ones, however, and that quietly festered with some operators. She sympathized, but secretly felt as if it were punishment for turning their backs. That was, as Ollie pointed out, her one weakness. Kali and Ollie's official honeymoon came when they were deployed to Ottawa to search for the whereabouts of the previous JTF recon teams sent there. Upon determining the fate of those operators and the discovery that Whitecap had fallen, she and Ollie realized they were on their own. Kali believed it had been justice that the underground shelter had been breached. Ollie was more clinical in his assessment. The virus had simply found a way in. Some heated discussions had followed between the pair, debating what to do in the absence of a command structure, but they both eventually agreed on one plan. Gather whoever was left, whoever was willing to join them, and start over. It was a proactive mission that Kali found much to her liking. However, the world had changed, gone savage. The undead were the easiest to deal with, shoot them on sight. The human element was far more cunning, devious, and in some cases, warlike. Kali figured it was just after 9 in the morning, when the town seemed mired in sleep. Nothing stirred as she snaked her way through backyards, closing in on the bridge. A single forest green bungalow came into sight, ringed with a smashed fence that reminded her of broken teeth. The house stood on the right, its broken out picture window giving a shooter ideal coverage of both sides of the river and anyone attempting to cross. There was the chance that no one actually lived on the south side, that they'd relocated to the motel, perhaps even fortified their position. Kali hugged the corner of one house, looked both ways before proceeding, and walked across the street as if she belonged. Her senses crackled in the morning silence, eyes flicking side to side, ears on ten. She appeared outwardly calm, as though she belonged to the gang, albeit dressed differently. She suppressed the urge to sprint, forcing herself to take her time to the house. If anyone noticed her and stopped to stare, she'd have only a second or two before her ruse failed. The house loomed closer, and she walked around the back, found the rear door, tried the knob, and found it locked. As if fumbling for a key, she reached up her sleeve and extracted a small, thin blade, inserted it into the slit between door and doorframe, located the bolt, and knifed her way into the house. All was quiet inside. Kali closed the door and walked through a filthy kitchen area, hugging the walls and taking her time peeking into doorways. A smell of alcohol and body odor permeated the house. Her gun came up, left hand steadying the right. The living room was empty, but three hunting rifles lay across a green sofa. An opposing hallway had two of three doors closed. A toilet flushed. Kali silently blurred to the side of the bathroom door and waited, gun pointed at the space where a head would appear. Someone snorted, horked and spat, followed by a muttering of words. Fingers fumbled on a doorknob. Then two doors opened, the room that Kali had covered and the other down the hall on the opposite side. She didn't hesitate. The man in her sights got his head blown off, decorating the wall and drizzling the air with bloody pulp before she smoothly adjusted her aim and double-tapped a blonde woman in her chest and face. The blast flung the blonde back with a meaty racket, the door sprayed with head jam and other clumps of sagging matter. Kali did a quick scan of the bathroom, hopped over the t-shirt-wearing man corpse in the hall and went to the open door. She led with her gun, using the wall as cover, and saw that the dead female's bedroom was empty. Having cleared two rooms, she went to the last open doorway and found it vacant. A quick search revealed the closets full of clothes and well-used sports padding. The beds rested directly on the floor, so there was nowhere to hide there. Kali stalked back into the kitchen, deeming the house clear. The living room might have been a mosh pit the night before, and parts of the carpet seemed to have either been ripped or chewed through. Empty booze bottles rattled and rolled underfoot, garnished with empty brass shell casings. Kali stopped and took a quick look out of the picture window, seeing how it lined up with the sofa. Lazy. People could sit there and watch the road, rifles in hands, without having to lift their asses. The indentations in the cushion spoke of many long hours for the shooters. Kali went back to the closet where she'd seen the gear and clothes. She took a light jacket and a pair of cargo pants, both of which she pulled over herself. Having done that, she returned to the living room and picked up the nearest bolt action, a Remington, chestnut stock with a scope missing its strap, rubber on the grip, hinged floor plate with a full four-shot magazine and one already in the pipe, good for at least 300 yards. She looked it over and deemed it solid and capable enough, but she didn't like using untested weapons. If she remained lucky, she wouldn't have to worry about that. She jammed the Sig Sauer into her waistband and practiced pulling it free twice. The suppressor hooked both times, but Kali didn't see any alternative. She hefted the rifle and saw an old Red Wings cap hanging from a peg. That went over her masthead. If she could get across the bridge, then all was peaches and cream. Chapter 31. A breeze ushered her across the bridge. Rusty guardrails, crumpled in places, ran along the edges of the construction. The dark water below flowed west, gurgling along, conjuring little whirlpools. Ahead, the remaining houses, service station, and motel seemed to press themselves into a tall fence of fir and spruce trees, all under an ominous carpet of cloud. Kali sauntered across at an outwardly leisurely pace, appearing unconcerned with the world, holding the Remington across her pelvis. Her balaclava kept the chill morning air from her face, the weather reason enough for a person to wear a mask. Her boots clicked off pavement riddled with potholes and long cracks resembling spent lightning bolts, the sound of her passing disturbing the otherwise peaceful morning. Halfway over the bridge, she kept pace, scanning the houses for lookouts or signs of life, and seeing none. Whoever had taken the motorhomes had completely relaxed their guard. Kali felt the gun in her waistband slip a finger, forcing her to adjust it while laying the rifle across one shoulder as if in a parade. The breeze slashed at her eyes, making her blink. No one approached her, no one called out. Even better, no shots fired. She allowed herself a mental sigh of relief upon getting across. Without breaking stride, she sauntered toward the motel and the collage of vehicles parked there, several of which she recognized as belonging to her. She reached the nearest RV, walked along its length and paused, listening for voices or snoring. Nothing. The front of the RV beckoned, and she slunk around the front, crouching. The main entrance of the motel wasn't more than 12 meters away, the glass doors smashed out and replaced with stained slabs of wood. A slot had been cut into the surface at eye level for peeking out at visitors. She looked up and spotted, just underneath the Cozy Inn sign, a rifle barrel sticking out over the edge of the roof.
I see you.
Collie walked to the base of the building. Most of the windows had been boarded up on the outside. She walked around to the back, passing a secondary entrance that had been likewise fortified, as well as a ringed escape ladder going up to the roof. Collie placed the rifle against the motel wall and climbed, focusing on the top, willing the area above her to be clear. In short time, she reached the top and paused. She heard the soft buzz of a snore. Not believing her luck, she scaled the top and saw a fire escape door leading to the motel's second floor. Across from that was a man dressed as if on a hunting spree and sleeping on his back. His head rested against the lower portion of one of the Z's in Cozy Inn, with a stocking cap pulled down over his eyes. Collie crept to the fire escape door and hid behind the housing unit. She drew her knife and snuck toward the sleeping man. Once beside him, Collie slapped her hand over his mouth, drove her knee to his chest, and stabbed the entire length of the blade up under his chin, hilt deep, skewering his brain. His arms shivered as she pinned him, relaxing a second later. She rooted the blade back and forth before extracting the weapon and wiping it off on his shirt. A heartbeat later, she returned to the fire escape door, surprised to see the guard had jammed a slat of wood against its base to prevent the door from completely closing. Collie pulled it open with a faint, rusty yawn. Then she was inside.
Holy shit, was that her? Gus demanded, squinting at the distant motel.
That was her. Sweet Christ, did she kill him?
Wallace turned, his mouth twisting into a "course she killed him" sneer.
Holy shit. Holy shit, I mean, of course we couldn't hear anything from here, but that was her.
Let's get moving, Wallace said, and started down the hill, keeping inside the tree line.
We're back up?
She doesn't need backup.
The air inside the building was fresh, and Collie stealthily descended a flight of stairs to the second floor and paused at another door. She listened at its surface, heard nothing, and decided to proceed. The hinges groaned softly as she pulled it open, making her cringe, but no one responded. Collie eased into an alcove filled with two smashed vending machines for snacks and soft drinks, and an empty ice freezer. There were no working lights, leaving the hallway in deep shadows. A worn carpet covered the floor, which Collie appreciated. She peeked around the corner, seeing that the corridor ran north and south, and she was pretty much in the middle. Another staircase was situated around the corner from the